What was your reaction when you were first asked to participate in this benefit performance?
Well, when I heard about this benefit, it's just a very distinguished honor for me to be part of this. It's something that I believe in very much, and it's great to be part of it.
You don't usually get involved in this type of thing, I assume, the benefit?
Well, I do. Actually, I just look to get involved with this more than anything else, with this kind of thing, which is, anything that can kind of lift ourselves up by our bootstraps whenever we can do this. It's always good for our country.
We sure need it here.
Great. Well, that's good. Glad you're doing it.
Have you been in the auditorium yet?
No, not yet.
No, that's not. Oh, it's not right on the other side.
Oh,
of the
I see. Right.
This one just passed when we told her it was originally building for a swimming pool.
Yeah.
That's a myth, though.
Oh,
it's
a myth.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Right.
It'll help, though, if you have to sing without mics because the ceilings are all tiled.
But it's acoustic tile. It looks like hard, but it's... Our auditorium is, it's a very venerable place, but...
What is acoustical tile?
Well, it's made out of, we have cork here on this wall. It's similar to that, a little bit less porous, and it tends to, reduce the tremendous reflections you might have over a ceramic wall or, ceramic tile.
I see.
It looks a little bit like a bathroom, but it doesn't.
I wish it would.
Yeah, bathrooms are great.
It'd make it a lot easier.
The maximum capacity is 4,000, so it's a big place.
I see.
Part of the complaint. The new place would have 2,500 seats, and it's just easier to perform in a place like that.
Oh, yes, it's more acoustical.
Financially, it's a little harder to work out.
Well, if Carnegie Hall can do it. That's the size of their hall, 2,700 seats.
Is it 2,700? That's all?
Mm-hmm. Jeez. It looks like there's 10,000 when you stand on stage. It has that feeling. It's just psychological, I guess, and between the way it looks and then also the history of Carnegie. But the balconies are way up there, and it looks like it's really a lot bigger than it is.
But it's one of the finest halls in the...
Acoustically, it's perfect. Well, that's because, wood is a musician's friend, and it's made out of wood.
Regarding your performing, when and how did you get involved in performing?
Well, when I was 6 years old, I always kind of had this automatic drive to entertain people. And it just kind of drove me right through my life. Into just concentrating on that.
Who were some of the singers who influenced you in your early career?
Well, Sinatra and when I was a little boy, Eddie Cantor and Al Jolson.
You seem to be influenced by jazz a lot more than some of the others.
Well, it's the only culture America has. It's the only thing we could really call our own. It kind of explains our whole viewpoint about things in many ways, so that I'm always fascinated by the early beginnings and well on into the... I like the music of the 20s and 30s, and I love the spirit of the 40s, so that I kind of... my roots and education are based on that, those times.
Professionally, you started at the end of the 40s, right?
Yes.
Because of You was your first...
Yes, in 1950.
And that must have sold close to what San Francisco sold. No?
Yes. Yeah, that was one of those records that stayed on the charts and got everybody angry in the music business because it wouldn't get off the charts. Just stayed up there for about 9 months.
What's the story behind I Left My Heart in San Francisco? That was by some obscure composer.
Yeah, well, not really obscure. He had written songs for Billie Holiday and Douglas Cross and George Corey, the two boys from San Francisco. And the song had been on the shelf for about 7 years. And I think the only time it was ever performed was by some obscure opera singer. And it was kind of just left there. And Ralph Sharon, who's now with Robert Goulet as music director, was with me at the time. And he was pretty clever in finding things for me, and he heard that I was going to the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco, and he had suggested that I do the song so that it would be a piece of special material for the narcissistic fans of San Francisco, and it would help us go over in the town. And it really worked. When I released it, though, it was a funny thing. I put it on the other side of a song called Once Upon a Time from Broadway musical All-American. And it had been originally the B-side. We didn't work on it as a plug song or anything. And it was turned over by all the disc jockeys in America, and they started playing the B-side of the record. And it helped me an awful lot throughout my lifestyle, because it opened up an international career for me, like Mexico and Australia, Canada, France, and Italy, and Sweden, and I went to places I had never dreamed I'd ever go to. So I'm very grateful for the song.
Where are you from originally?
From New York City.
You're not from Italy?
No, my parents are. My father is, but my mother was born in America.
What is your real name? Your last name?
Anthony Dominic Benedetto.
Ah, okay. Molto bene.
Right.
I'm Sicilian.
Good, I'm Calabrese.
Mm-hmm. Bob Hope had something to do with giving you Bennett, huh?
Now, that's funny you mentioned that. I was with Bob last night, where he just received an honorary award at Notre Dame. And he ended up keeping me up last night. We ended up, he's younger than springtime, you know, he's took me to a Playboy club, and they forced me to get up and sing, and he did comedy, and it's unbelievable. He just goes on and on and never stops, and he looks better than he ever did. May I have a cup of coffee, please?
Oh,
thanks.
This may be warm. I'll check with Sally.
Well, if it's any trouble, forget about it, you know.
No.
What have you been doing recently? Concerts and clubs and so forth, or what?
Well, we just closed at the Schubert Theater in Los Angeles with Lena Horne. And that was a very nice engagement, because we broke all house records at the Schubert Theater. And I've been playing around with Count Basie in Cleveland, the Front Row Theater there, and we're going to London next.
Have you done a lot of foreign travel recently?
Not recently. In the last 8 years, I have.
Do you find that the audience are more enthusiastic when they are here?
No, they're about the same, but the only difference, there is a difference in custom. Maybe it's the nature of Britain and the fact that it's a real compact, small, functional country. There's a stronger loyalty level that sustains a lot longer. It's not as fickle as American audiences that kind of go with all kinds of fads and in and out of fashions. You know, if they like someone over there, then it sticks and it stays that way for a lifetime. They don't change their mind.
What do you think of rock music?
Well, it's all right. I don't like acid rock. I don't like any angry music, or, you know, I just don't go for any unmelodic music. I'm a melody man myself, and this is the kind of music I personally like. But, you know, there's room for everybody, but I go for much more mature music.
Are there particular artists of today that you enjoy more than others?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, the biggest influence on me and everybody else have been the Beatles, and also Paul Williams, and Jim Webb.
Jimmy Webb?
Mm-hmm. Very good composer. And Kris Kristofferson. There's a few that are really solid performers. I like Elton John, too. There's some people around that will sustain and will, you know, when the whole era kind of fades out, it looks like it's going that way now. That was just a big, giant fad. I asked the same question to Fred Astaire about 5 years ago, what he thought of all this new kind of music, and he said, well, when I was young and I was going to school, he said, we used to eat goldfish. That's how he described it.
Your comment about, you know, music with melody and it appeals to my prejudice. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we were going to see a trend back toward that kind of writing?
I don't think it'll ever go away. You know, I mean, it's hard to beat a Cole Porter. And no one has yet. You know, he's very clever and very good. And, but there are certain ones that will hang in there, that do have the craftsmanship. And the Beatles are one group, even though they're not together, they're still a very talented, communicative group of musicians. And that, as I say, Paul Williams, I just think, is terrific. I mean, I just think he has a great feel for writing songs and a great sense of humor. I think he'll be around quite a while.
What about Burt Bacharach?
Well, he's very good. Yeah, he's another good one. There's enough room. I think it's funny enough with all the age of promotion that we're in right now. It's interesting to me that the business never really does change. Because it's still about, averages out to about the same group of maybe 4 or 5 new ones, like any other era, that really stick, and the rest were all good tries, and they kind of drifted into publishing, and which is, they're better off with, you know, because they'll become the future businessmen of the music business. And they had enough taste in music to have enough experience to see what it feels like to work live, and so I think they'll drift off into publishing, a lot of the fads that we're going through.
What can we get for your coffee? Do you like cream or sugar?
Cream and sugar, thanks.
Warm.
Right.
Put an electric bulb in it, too.
the programs, they say something about starting a record company?
Right. Yeah, I'm right in the beginning of organizing one, and it's taking a lot of time.
Yeah, it must
to do it right, you know.
Yeah.
It's, this is... casualty rate is unbelievable with guys who want to take a shot at the record business and then they just fail quickly. Mm-hmm. And to do it, you have to be very careful of, you know, how your product is distributed. And
right. Who gets it?
Who gets it? And that's
right.
Worked
right.
On.
Just a little side comment. Being a music director over at WMSN, it's, you know, I get so many records. It's unbelievable. You know, I usually get like duplicates and triplicates of everything, and a lot of that is waste, you know. And they're sending me like classical music, which I would never play, or
mm-hmm.
the radio station would never play because of, you know, the type of format we have. And I don't know, it just seems that there's a lot of waste that is involved in the situation, or in the record business itself. And
well, it's not the classical records that are in the way, it's the other records are in the way of the classical records, I
right,
think.
Right, okay.
You know, in other words, it's planned obsolescence, you know,
right.
I mean,
sure.
They've just started, it really became a very kind of cold business because they started planning how many units they can sell, you know, just
mm-hmm.
like a pair of shoes. And this has nothing to do with art and individuals and the individual talent of the performers that make something happen. It clouds they give us slogans like people like Lena Horne and myself, Perry Como and Sinatra, who have done a lot of business through the years and have good, solid fans, and they call us middle of the road. Well, I don't like that phrase. I think it's very incorrect. They've used a lot of words that are misused words, like contemporary music.
Sure.
You know, to me, contemporary music was always someone avant-garde like Schoenberg or Bartok or Stravinsky, and then for them to say that some idiot playing 3 chords is contemporary, that's a very misused phrase. And also the middle of the road, well, you know, no one likes to feel wishy-washy.
Right.
You know, if
right.
anything, the middle of the road artists are quite liberal and have the craftsmanship to have learned their craft
mm-hmm.
and are the artists that have sacrificed and do happen to do the thing right. You know, the Mills Brothers, I just saw them up in Toronto and they're just doing the same amount of business that they were doing many years ago because
they've
been solid, and they've been in the business long.
Oh, man.
And this is one thing that everybody is missing out on, the fact that longevity happens to be one of the keys to staying in business instead of just being in business overnight and fading out.
Who do you plan to pull in to your company? What kind of people do you want?
Well,
it just seems to me like people, they already got their own labels or they're already working.
No, they don't. No, they don't. In fact, it's pretty strange, you know, because the record companies are just like Ralph Nader says, they're the big corporations of the new mafia. They kind of enslave thousands of people if they can, you know, and just keep them under their wing. And so that the Elton Johns and myself and certain people, certain jazz artists that I know like Mary McPartland, Bobby Hackett, Stan Kenton, they're starting their own mail order business. They're trying their own little companies and getting a little taste for themselves.
Stan Kenton is a creative world.
Creative world, right. And it seems to be working, and it works a lot better because you don't have producers cutting into your timing, telling you that you don't know what you're doing and you shouldn't do this because we have demographics to prove that a certain group won't listen to this and all that kind of nonsense.